Hello and welcome to Oxtalk for Tuesday the 24th of June 2025. My name is Guy and I've compiled the edition for this week. News items have been selected from local Oxford papers by Christine Churchill and Mandy Wood and recorded at home by Christine Churchill and Hazel Hobbs. The USBs have been copied and distributed by Michelle Lawful. Sunrise today is at 4:46 a.m. and sunset is at 9:28 p.m. Before the news, we mark some events which happened on June the 24th in history. In 1314, the two-day Battle of Bannockburn concluded in victory for the Scottish army led by Robert the Bruce over the army of King Edward II of England, leading eventually to Scotland regaining independence from England. In 1374, there was a sudden outbreak of St. John's Dance, also known as Dancing Mania, Dancing Plague, Choreomania and St. Vitus Dance, which caused people in the streets of Aachen, Germany, to experience hallucinations and begin to jump and twitch uncontrollably until they collapse from exhaustion. In 1509, Henry VIII was crowned King of England at Westminster Abbey alongside his wife, Catherine of Aragon. The coronation was a grand affair and involved a spectacular procession from the Tower of London to the Abbey, followed by a lavish banquet in Westminster Hall. On this same day, 31 years later, Henry was again in the news, this time for expelling his fourth wife, Anne of Cleves, from his court. In 1963, the Telcam, the first home video recorder, was demonstrated at BBC Studios in London. The device had been developed by the Nottingham Electronic Valve Company, and marked a significant step towards making home video recording accessible to consumers. In 2016, British Prime Minister David Cameron resigned after the UK voted to leave the European Union, having fought on the side of Remain. And births on this day. In 1533, Robert Dudley, favourite of Elizabeth I, was born. On Elizabeth's accession, he was appointed Master of the Horse. He later became a Privy Councillor and Lord Steward of the Royal Household. In 1564, he became the Earl of Leicester and from 1563 was one of the greatest landowners in North Wales and the English West Midlands. In 1850, Field Marshal Horatio Herbert Kitchener, 1st Earl Kitchener, was born in Ballylongford, County Kerry, Ireland. As a British general, he commanded British forces during the Battle of Omdurman in Sudan in 1898 and then led forces in the Second Boer War. He became Secretary of State for War during World War I. In 1912, Brian Johnston, British cricket commentator and cake aficionado, was born in Little Berkhamsted, England. In 1987, Lionel Messi, Argentine footballer reputedly named after singer Lionel Richie, was born in Rosario, Argentina. During his career, Messi has won the Ballon d'Or 6 times, the European Golden Boot 6 times, 10 La Liga titles, 4 UEFA Champions League titles, and 6 Copa del Rey titles. And deaths on this day. In 1519, Lucrezia Borgia, Italian noblewoman, illegitimate daughter of Pope Alexander VI, died aged 39. Notorious tales about her family have cast Lucrezia as a femme fatale, a controversial role in which she has been portrayed in many artworks, novels and films. In 1604, Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford and Lord Great Chamberlain of England, died aged 54. He was a court favourite, a sought-after patron of the arts and noted by his contemporaries as a lyric poet and court playwright. In 1920, a theory was proposed that De Vere wrote the plays and poems attributed to William Shakespeare, although this theory is not supported by many today. In 1908, Grover Cleveland, 22nd and 24th US President, died aged 71. He was the first US President to serve non-consecutive terms and the first Democrat elected President after the American Civil War. In 2012, Lonesome George, a Pinta Island giant tortoise and the last known individual of his subspecies, died aged around 100. Now, on to the news. We hope you enjoy our selection of articles.
A miniature museum and a home for a defibrillator are just two ways Oxford organisations are making use of the city's iconic telephone boxes. An investigation by the Oxford Mail revealed the shocking state of the area's listed red kiosks, once a vital way for people to communicate. Most of the city boxes are the K2 and K6 box designs from Sir Giles Gilbert Scott, and have become recognisable protected landmarks around Oxford. However, several are in a terrible state, with the K6 version on St Giles East not only having several glass panes missing, but also its door removed. This has happened as more of the phones inside them get decommissioned. In fact, BT figures show that calls made from its public telephones have fallen by around 90% in the past decade. But some organisations are finding other uses for them. One of the most impressive is the listed K6 box on Pembroke Street, now used as a display by the Oxford Story Museum, which celebrates stories in all forms. Called the Story Museum, exhibitions assistant at the museum, Shona Blake, explained there have been many different presentations within it. The first was made in 2012, and since then, the tableaus have been inspired by The Owl and the Pussycat and Father Christmas, as well as Halloween, the Oxford Half Marathon and Pancake Day. Acquired for £1 in April 2011 under BT's Adopt a Kiosk scheme, Ms Blake says lots of people comment on it. She said there's often someone photographing it as they pass by, and it always raises a smile from children and grown-ups. Ms Blake said that it does require regular upkeep, as the museum consistently keeps an eye on damp and damage, and because something new is added every few weeks. "I make accessories from polymer clay, and I also sew the mice their outfits," she said, adding, "We love our telephone box, and the Story Museum is a firm fixture in our creative programme." To the northeast of the city, in the village of Stanton St John, the Talk House takes its name from its neighbouring phone box. Nick Duval, who runs the pub, said that in 2023 he saw a sign from BT that said the box was to be removed. He said, "Having worked for BT for most of my life prior to moving into the pub trade, I contacted BT payphones, who explained the process of adoption. They laid out the steps needed to buy it, and Fuller's Brewery subsequently took ownership, suggesting it was fitted with a defibrillator, which they sponsored." Mr. Duval said, "We soon had our K6 box back to its gleaming best, complete with its life-saving device and associated signage." BT's Adopt a Kiosk programme, the primary way for communities to make use of the telephone boxes, can be found on its website.
On Saturday, June the 14th, thousands lined the streets to remember a firefighter who lost her life in the Bicester Motion fire. Jenny Logan died while tackling the blaze on Buckingham Road on May the 15th. The 30-year-old was given a full ceremonial fire service funeral, with mourners paying tribute to her bravery, fearlessness and dedication to Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue Service. Miss Logan, from Bicester, died alongside firefighter Martin Sadler, 38, and 57-year-old father of two, Dave Chester. She was only the second female fighter to die on duty in peacetime, following Fleur Lombard, 21, who died in Bristol in 1996. A public procession, starting at 10 a.m., saw Miss Logan's coffin draped in the Union flag being carried atop an aerial ladder platform fire engine through the streets of Bicester. Hundreds of people gathered along the route in respectful silence while uniformed firefighters marched behind the coffin. A minute's silence was held outside Bicester's fire station before the cortege moved along King's End to the church. A private service followed at the request of Miss Logan's family. Miss Logan and Mr. Sadler were also members of Bicester Rugby Union Club, and club members also lined the route. "She loved rugby, but above all, she was a firefighter. People from all over the country travelled to Bicester to pay their respects. Matt Smith, a retired firefighter, travelled from Lincolnshire. He'd served for Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue. Before the procession, he said, "My dad was an officer as well, and I just want to show my respect for the work that these people do. Remembering Jenny and Martin, it's absolutely awful what happened, of course. I feel emotional, really. It was lovely to see so many people come to show their respects to the local community. The fire brigade is one big family, and you know, I think it gets people's hearts very humbling." Monica Mayers, 80, has lived in Bicester for 13 years. She told us, "It's just amazing to see the tribute paid. Apparently they've come from all over the country, the firefighters. It's wonderful to see them, and I just hope I never see it again." Golden plaques have been put up outside Bicester Fire Station in memory of Miss Logan, Mr. Chester and Mr. Sadler. A friend, Miss Bryson, said that recently Jenny was telling me how much she loved being in the fire service and that she had definitely found her calling in life. As tributes poured in after the tragedy, Miss Logan's family described her as their hero. Her bravery and fearlessness shone right through until the end, they said. She will always be our hero, and we are so immensely proud of her, forever in our hearts.
A golden toilet has returned to Blenheim Palace under very serious watch after a duo were jailed for stealing an 18-carat gold loo worth nearly £5 million. Blenheim Palace released a humorous picture of a stern-looking security guard standing next to the imitation golden lavatory. Palace staff joked, "The throne has returned, and this time it's under very serious watch. Come and see the golden loo shining bright on the water terraces, because everyone deserves a royal flush." It came after James Sheen, 40, and Michael Jones, 39, were sentenced to jail last week after being convicted of stealing a golden toilet worth £4.75 million from the former home of Winston Churchill. This was described by the judge as a bold and brazen heist at Oxford Crown Court during the sentencing. At the time of its installation, it was insured for the sum of $6 million, £4.75 million. Two men have been sentenced to jail after being convicted of stealing a golden toilet worth £4.75 million from Blenheim Palace. James Sheen, 40, from Wellingborough, Northamptonshire, who the Crown Prosecution Service referred to as a career criminal who masterminded the theft, received a four-year prison sentence for his part in the raid. He will spend the next 23 years and 4 months of his life in jail, serving 4 years for the three counts in this case and the rest for previous convictions. He pleaded guilty to one count each of burglary, money laundering and transferring criminal property in connection with the golden toilet theft in April this year. Michael Jones, 39, from Oxford, who, according to the CPS, carried out reconnaissance trips to Blenheim Palace before the raid, was sentenced to 27 months in jail. Jones was found guilty of burglary after the trial. Judge Ian Pringle, KC, called it a bold and brazen heist. The sentencing took place at Oxford Crown Court on Friday of last week, bringing the trials for the high-profile burglars to a close. The 18-carat gold, fully functioning toilet, entitled America by artist Maurizio Cattelan, had been installed as an artwork at the Oxfordshire country house where Sir Winston Churchill was born. At the time of its installation, it was insured for the sum of $6 million, £4.75 million, and the gold it was made from was itself worth in the region of £2.8 million at the time. It was stolen within days of it being opened to the public on September the 19th, 2020, when five men in two vehicles pulled up to the front of Blenheim Palace to complete the audacious heist. They smashed a window near the artworks gallery and removed the toilet with a sledgehammer, leaving water pouring out of the pipes before fleeing the scene. Judge Pringle KC said, "This bold and brazen heist took no more than 5.5 minutes to complete. America was never seen again." However, defence counsel for Sheen, Mr. Jeffrey Israel, said in mitigation, "Both the planning and execution were incredibly basic. Effective, but basic. Although it was brazen, it was not sophisticated." Sheen, who was 35 at the time of the offending, was already serving a total of 19 years and 4 months for offences including serious acquisitive crime. The additional sentence of 4 years will run consecutively to that sentence. He was one of the gang of 5 men who smashed into the palace to steal the toilet. It is believed to have been melted down for the gold. It was sold in Birmingham for nearly £500,000. Frederick Doe, 37, also known as Frederick Sines, from Berkshire, was found guilty of conspiracy to transfer criminal property as a foolish middleman and handed a suspended sentence last month. A Proceeds of Crime Act hearing to establish financial gains the burglars made will be held at the same court on January the 16th, 2026, jointly for Sheen, Jones, and previously sentenced Doe. Sean Saunders for the Crown Prosecution Service said, "This was an extraordinary case in many respects. It is not every day that we prosecute high-value burglaries of stately homes, let alone the audacious theft of an 18-carat gold toilet." However, given the level of planning that enabled the raid to be carried out within 5 minutes, it was unusual that the offenders left such a trail of evidence in their wake. From phone messages to DNA traces found in a stolen car and on the sledgehammer used in the burglary, this wealth of evidence ultimately enabled us to secure their convictions. We reviewed nearly 30,000 pages of evidence as we built our case, including a significant amount of material from Jane Sheen's phone. We examined text messages, images, and hours of voice recordings, many of which implicated other individuals. Sheen and those he communicated with used code and slang, and it required careful analysis to decipher these messages, to understand how the raid was carried out, and how the stolen gold was disposed of. 3 of the individuals involved in this crime have now been sentenced, and we believe this prosecution has played a part in disrupting a wider crime and money laundering network.
Here are 3 of a number of articles concerning the County Council's vote on Tuesday the 17th about implementing congestion charges in Oxford City, and a longer article about how Westgate Ward would be affected. First, drivers in Oxford could be fined up to £70 under proposals for a new congestion charge, it has been confirmed. Oxfordshire County Council's proposed congestion charge has faced much debate from politicians and householders since it was unveiled as a solution to traffic problems on June the 9th. Oxford City Centre would be the only place in the county affected with daily charge of £5 being proposed for drivers. If approved, the charge locations would be in Hythebridge Street, St Cross Street, Thames Street and St Clements every day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Marston Ferry Road and Hollow Way would see charges Monday to Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. And now the County Council has confirmed that should drivers not pay for driving past the automatic number plate recognition, the ANPR cameras, they could face a fine of up to £70. However, this will only be charged if not paid within 21 days, a fine of £35 if applied, paid early. The County Council says an additional £500,000 is needed for new signs and adaptation to the back office systems to add a charging module. It is proposed to fund this through the Congestion Relief Fund, with the Council's approved capital programme allocated to the Botley Road mitigation package as a result of the road being closed for network rail works at the train station. Second, more than 9,000 people have now signed a petition against plans for a congestion charge on several roads in Oxford. A petition was launched on June the 9th, the day the County Council made the decision by independent councillor Saj Malik and Reconnecting Oxford, which urges the council to ditch the plans and scrap the existing low-traffic neighbourhoods in East Oxford and Cowley instead. The petition gained almost 2,000 signatures in less than 24 hours and now has just over 9,000 signatures, as well as more than 5,600 comments. If approved at the County Council meeting on June the 17th, there'll be a 6-week consultation period beginning on June the 23rd, and the scheme could be implemented as soon as the autumn. It aims to deal with congestion in the interim before the planned traffic filter trial begins, after it was pushed back to the expected reopening of Botley Road in August 2026. And the third, on Tuesday, June the 17th, the Oxford Mail had the headline, "The 10 County Council Cabinet members who will vote on the congestion charges, only one lives in Oxford." The article listed the 10 and pointed out that Andrew Gant is Cabinet Minister for Transport and is the only Cabinet Minister who both lives in and represents a division, an area, within the city boundaries. The other 9 are Liz Heffman, leader of Oxfordshire County Council, Tim Bearder, Neil Fawcett, Sean Gall, Kate Gregory, Jenny Hannaby, Ben Higgins, Dan Levy and Judy Roberts. None lives inside the city boundaries or represents a division there. Shoppers have said they may no longer use the city's Westgate Centre should plans for a new congestion charge be introduced. Oxfordshire County Council is considering introducing a £5 daily congestion charge for parts of Oxford city centre. This includes Thames Street, which is used by drivers going to Westgate to park their car in the multi-storey. But some shoppers have told Oxford Mail that they would not want to pay the charge in addition to car parking fees. Didcot consultant Phil Bartlett, 53, said he would look elsewhere if the council doesn't want cars in the city. He said, "It's going to hurt businesses massively, I think. I don't know if I'd be prepared to pay another fiver on top of the parking. Westgate is nice, but I'd definitely look to shop somewhere else if we're having to pay for extras." Former teacher Chris Stoyanov from Swindon said he would ditch not just Westgate but Oxford city centre too in favour of Bristol. The 64-year-old said, "Today I've had to pay a huge £15 to park for 2 hours with my family. I come from Swindon and I would definitely come to Westgate less often than I do now because of the congestion charge." The Bulgarian-born former teacher said, "Prices are already too high here. We pay so much in taxes," and said he would look to cut back in other areas such as Westgate. Another resident said extra charges would put him off coming to get Westgate and that he would consider larger purchases online in future. "People rely on their cars, especially coming here, because you can buy a lot and it's not as easy on the bus." Meanwhile, not everybody was against the idea, including Christine Grieve, who is retired. Brian Freeman, 70, and from London, said he would definitely pay the proposed £5 congestion charge to visit Westgate. I have to pay the high congestion charge in London, so that's about £30 every time I start the car. £5 is nothing, he said. Westgate's representatives and centre director Brendan Hattam declined to offer their stance on the proposed congestion charge, which will affect the business. A statement read, "We are aware of the consultation and are liaising with Oxford County Council and Oxford City Council to better understand what this means for Oxford as a whole, as well as here at Westgate, Oxford."
From a wildlife champion to a road safety campaigner and conservationist, meet the Oxfordshire residents who have been recognised in the King's Birthday Honours List. The King's Birthday Honours List 2025 marks the incredible public service of individuals from across the UK and includes numerous recipients from Oxfordshire. Joining the 28 county residents being recognised this year is Cotswold's very own David Beckham, who is to be knighted. Lucy Cluver, a Professor of Child and Family Social Work at the University of Oxford, has been made an OBE for services to children's well-being and global public health. She has researched effective interventions that have improved the lives of millions of children and teenagers in Africa and lower middle-income countries. Lucy said, "I'm amazed and delighted by this honour. All our work is driven by an incredible team of partners across Africa and the UK and students and colleagues here in Oxford. We're lucky to live and work in this city that inspires my thinking every day about what is possible." Margaret Day said she is very honoured to have been made BEM for services to the community in Kidlington. She said, "A lot of this is due to the connections with church life, but they're not all related to this. One of the things I do is look after Kidlington News, a magazine for Kidlington. I do the layout of it, which is absolute fun, and I deliver it to subscribers around." Margaret is also a trustee of food banks in North Oxfordshire, including in Kidlington, Woodstock and Chipping Norton. Charlotte Charles, the mother of 19-year-old Harry Dunn, has said she feels undeserving of her MBE because she was a mum who was just totally broken. Charlotte from Banbury said her work on road safety following the crash that resulted in her son's death in 2019 was an avenue to direct my grief down. Harry was killed when a Volvo driven by then US State Department employee Anne Sakoulis hit him while on the wrong side of the road outside RAF Croughton in Northamptonshire. Christina Cunliffe, principal of the McTimony College of Chiropractic, has been appointed an OBE for services to health education. She is said to have taken the Abingdon-based college from a single site to a global entity. It now has campuses in Oxfordshire, Manchester, Madrid, Hong Kong, and soon in Northern Ireland. Estelle Bailey, Chief Executive of Berkshire, Buckinghamshire and Oxford Wildlife Trust, has been made a BME for services to nature's recovery.
Drivers have been fined nearly £750,000 since 2023 for using a mobile phone behind the wheel. Fines of £200 and 6 penalty points on your driver's licence are dished out to drivers caught using their phone. Thames Valley Police sent out 230 fixed penalty notices to drivers between January the 1st and March the 7th this year. That works out at an average of between 3 and 4 mobile phone offences being committed every day in the Thames Valley area. A law against making mobile phone calls or sending messages while driving in Great Britain has been placed since 2003. The data shows 1,733 fines were issued in 2023, followed by another 1,729 last year across Oxfordshire, Berkshire and Buckinghamshire. Accident Claims Advice solicitor Michael Higgins said, "The number of mobile phone driving offences is extremely worrying, especially given the potentially devastating consequences of someone not paying full attention when operating a vehicle. A road traffic accident caused by someone looking at their phone while driving could turn a person's life upside down in a split second. It is important that they know that legal support is available to them if they want to seek compensation for the harm they've suffered. A police spokeswoman said, "Using a mobile phone while driving is extremely dangerous, primarily because it distracts drivers from the road and their surroundings."
Pop star Martin Kemp paid a visit to thrilled care home residents near Oxford with a pony who has previously gone viral online. Mr. Kemp, who is best known as the bassist in the new wave band Spandau Ballet and for his role as Steve Owen in EastEnders, visited Chorley Grove Care Home in Cumnor with miniature pony Poppy from Dinky Ponies in tow. According to the care home, the Spandau Ballet superstar couldn't resist the chance to swing by to meet residents after becoming a fan of Poppy via Instagram. In 2023, owner Sarah Woodland's Instagram video of Poppy meeting resident Connie went viral worldwide and resulted in her being interviewed on American television. Residents and staff couldn't believe their eyes when Mr. Kemp and his wife Shirley, who found fame with partner Pepsi as Wham's backing singers, turned up to say hello. But Mr. Kemp said he was the one who was wowed after meeting Poppy and star-struck residents, as well as getting a tour of the care home.
The post office branch in Oxford city centre will not be closing, but it will be operated by a retail franchise. Post office chairman Nigel Railton announced that 115 directly owned branches would close last November, with the St Aldate's branch included in the list. Councillors raised fears about how the closure would affect people who need to access the vital service. The branch at St Aldate's has been running since 1880. A petition to save the post office, which was set up by Councillor Susanna Pressel, garnered almost 2,000 signatures, but it has been announced that instead of closing, the St Aldate's branch will be run by an independent franchise retail partner, Universal Office Equipment, at the same premises. The same range of services will be available and the opening hours will remain largely the same, except the branch will open at 9 a.m. on Tuesdays instead of 9:30 a.m. The post office will not offer the opportunity for feedback on the change, but has opened a consultation on the opening hours. Reacting to the update, Ms. Pressel said, "It seems that we are not losing our central post office, which is good, but who knows what the new service will be like. Since the present service leaves a lot to be desired, perhaps it will actually be an improvement. Let's hope it's not wholly focused on making a profit for its shareholders. Any move would be unlikely to happen before spring 2026. An Oxford City Council deputy leader, Anna Railton, said it was fantastic that it's remaining open for residents of South Oxford and the rest of the city in its original historic building. She added, "I trust all the staff will all be retained on the same terms and conditions, and the same or better level of service is provided for customers."
Rhino poaching has been reduced by almost 80% since a group had their horns removed by conservationists, a study involving the University of Oxford has found. The study, which monitored more than 2,000 dehorned rhinos, found removing horns led to a 78% drop in poaching. The research was conducted across 11 reserves in South Africa's Greater Kruger region between 2017 and 2023. Poaching is a major threat to the world's five rhino species. Some believe the horns have medicinal properties and they fetch huge prices on the black market, particularly in Asia. Dr. Tim Keeper, lead author from Nelson Mandela University in South Africa, said, "Dehorning rhinos to reduce incentives for poaching, and 2,284 rhinos were dehorned across eight reserves, was found to achieve a 78% reduction in poaching using just 1.2% of the rhino protection budget. However, the research did show some poaching of dehorned rhinos for horn stumps and regrowth continued, while more recent evidence since the conclusion of the study in 2023 suggests this is a growing challenge. Professor Eleanor Milner-Gulland, co-author from University of Oxford, said, "This collaboration is a brilliant example of how the effectiveness of conservation interventions can be assessed quantitatively, even in challenging and complex situations, and how important the participation of on-the-ground practitioners is in initiating and interpreting such research."
King Charles III has been humbly asked to intervene against an £800 million solar project on the grounds of an act from the early 18th century. Set to be the largest solar farm in Europe, Botley West is to cover almost 3,500 acres of land across Botley, Woodstock and Kidlington. Since May, the Planning Inspectorate has been examining the scheme, a process which will take 6 months and eventually lead to a recommendation being sent to Energy and Net Zero Secretary Ed Miliband. Objectors, including members of Stop Botley West Group, have been campaigning against the project, and now a resident has written a letter asking the King to step in. Penned by Tim Sumner, its arguments are based around the 1705 Queen Anne Act of Parliament, which gave the Blenheim Estate, on which a lot of Botley West is being built upon, to the first Duke of Marlborough. The two main assertions are that the Blenheim Estate does not officially own the land, leasing it yearly for the payment of a flag, and that the 1705 Act states that it should not be used for any purpose other than the Duke's. This was included because Queen Anne was worried the estate would become part of a Germany, as John Churchill had also been granted the Principality of Mindelheim due to his successful war on the continent. Specially, the Act said the estate could only be granted to the said John Duke of Marlborough, his heirs and assigns forever, to the only use and behoof or in trust for the said Duke, heirs and assigns forever, and to no other use, intent or purpose whatsoever. As such, Mr. Sumner maintains that since the Crown leases the land to the Duke, the Crown must be consulted. In addition, he said, leasing and giving ownership of Blenheim land to a third party who will directly enjoy financial benefits is against the 1705 Queen Anne Act. He adds that the principles of the Act were not only upheld in the 1856 Blenheim Estates Act, when a 1,000-year parliamentary mortgage was created for the land, but also it was used as a reference point for Blenheim's World Heritage Agreement with UNESCO in 2017. Calling it his duty to raise these issues, Mr. Sumner signs off the letter by saying, "I therefore humbly ask that the Crown steps in to enforce its ownership of the Blenheim Estate as Queen Anne intended and refuses Blenheim Estate land to be handed over to any third party. Though His Majesty is yet to respond, the arguments were presented at a recent open floor hearing in Oxford, and the Planning Inspectorate has asked for further clarification from Blenheim." A spokesperson for the estate said, "We are aware of the comments made during the public examination, which are not correct in relation to this project." The director of PhotoVolt, the company behind the project, Mark Owen Lloyd, said he had full confidence in the agreements made.
A Clarkson's Farm star has announced a new venture after leaving the show. The young farmhand from Derbyshire was a new addition to the cast in the latest season, which was released on Prime Video across May and June this year. Ms Cowan temporarily stood in for long-time fan favourite Caleb Cooper as he toured, helping Jeremy Clarkson at the farm in Chadlington, Oxfordshire. The 24-year-old left midway through the series once her help was no longer needed, but became popular with viewers despite her short time on screen. After finding fame with the farming documentary show, Ms Cowan has now opted for a new career venture. Announced via the social media platform Instagram, the young star has signed with leading talent agency Off Limits Entertainment. A statement from Off Limits Entertainment said, "We're delighted to announce the exclusive signing of Harriet Cowan to Off Limits Entertainment." Harriet Cowan, best known for her standout role stepping in as Jeremy Clarkson's farmhand on Clarkson's Farm series, has quickly become one of the most exciting new voices in British farming. Harriet gained national attention for her expertise, quick wit, and genuine passion for agriculture. In addition to her national television success, Harriet has cultivated a rapidly growing online community across platforms like TikTok and Instagram, where she shares authentic and engaging insights into rural life, farming challenges, and the realities of modern agriculture. Harriet's background as a qualified nurse and her role as a spokesperson for young farmers makes her a relatable figure in the farming community and beyond. We're super excited to represent Harriet and support her on this new and exciting journey. Stay tuned to see what Harriet gets up to. With filming for Clarkson's Farm Series 5 already underway, it remains uncertain if Ms Cowan will return. The 24-year-old addressed her Clarkson's Farm future in a pre-recorded appearance on BBC Breakfast News earlier this month. "We've always left it very open," said Harriet. "I'm here if he needs me, but no plans at the minute. If he needs me, I'm here." Mr Clarkson previously spoke on the question when talking to The Sun, and offered similar thoughts on a potential return for the young star. "It's a reality show," he said. "We don't just bring characters in because the TV show needs it. You bring them in because you really need them. I loved Harriet to bits, and I wish her all the very best. She was fantastic to have around. But the truth is, we've got Caleb. He might go off and do Celebrity Love Island or something. And if I can't manage, I'll call Harriet in a heartbeat."
Jeremy Clarkson's Hawkstone beer is named after the Hawkstone in the Cotswolds, but, for those not in the know, what is it? The former Top Gear and Grand Tour presenter purchased Diddley Squat Farm in Chadlington, Oxfordshire, back in 2008. He has since documented his adventures getting to grips with farming in the Prime Video show Clarkson's Farm. With 4 series to date and a 5th currently filming, it's safe to say that the show has been a huge success. Watched across the globe, Diddley Squat regularly has visitors from all over the world. The most recent of these series came out last month, with 8 episodes in total released across May and June. Mr Clarkson's £1 million acquisition of the Windmill Pub in Astall near Burford is one of the main subjects of the new programmes. Renamed the Farmer's Dog, the pub serves a variety of 65-year-old alcohol brand Hawkstone. This includes a variety of lagers, ciders and stouts, as well as low-alcohol beers too. Hawkstone was founded by Mr Clarkson back in 2021, using the barley grown on his farm to make a lager. It is brewed by Hawkstone Brewery near Boughton-on-the-Water in Gloucestershire and is distributed by the Craft Drink Company. The brand was named after a Neolithic standing stone called the Hawkstone, which stands just north of the hamlet of Dean. It is believed to have been given the name due to its shape being like a hawk. Others suggest that it is instead a corruption of the word hoar, which means old. Made from oolithic limestone, some have argued that the stone was previously a part of a large burial chamber, but there is little evidence of this. There is a hole in the upper section of the hawk stone, which has been worn over time by visitors rubbing it for luck. In local legend, It is said that the top of the stone's cleft was created by chains of witches who were tied to the stone and burnt alive. The stone can be found just under 3 miles away from Diddley Squat Farm Shop and 12 miles from the Farmer's Dog Pub. It is aptly situated between farmer's fields, but can be accessed from the road with a grass walking route directly to the stone. When the lager was initially released, it became the top-selling beer on Amazon, and in 2024, the Waitrose became the first supermarket chain to sell it. Clarkson's Farm Series 5 is currently filming in Oxfordshire after it was confirmed by Mr. Clarkson at the end of last year. It is expected that the new episodes will be released in the new year.
An angler has landed a mega catch of carp at a popular fishery in Oxfordshire. Linear Fisheries near Whitney is well known for its huge carp, as well as stocks of other fish like pike and tench across its 16 lakes. Angler Reg Verney is the latest to celebrate some mega fish caught from the complex, this time fishing on Gaunt's Lake. Mr. Verney landed 6 carp, totalling £40, 13 ounces, with staff sharing, "All caught on handcraft baits, herb and skipjack boilies. Mega fish, Reg." Pictures of the impressive catches show Reg landed mirror, leather and common carp at the well-known fishery. The lakes have seen many huge carp catches and host annual World Carp Championships across several categories, bringing in fishing enthusiasts from all over the world. The site is off the B4449 near Hardwick Village and is well known as one of the best and most popular day ticket complexes in the UK.
Staff at the Store Hotel in Oxford are celebrating after winning the World's Best London Dry Gin title at the prestigious World Gin Awards 2025. The global recognition follows the store's earlier triumphant in May, when the same gin was named best in the country for England. The impressive accolade came just in time for World Gin Day on Tuesday, June the 17th. Crafted in collaboration with Berkshire-based Hawkridge Distillers, the store's London Dry Gin is created exclusively for the hotel in Broad Street. Judges from the World Gin Awards, a panel of expert distillers, industry professionals and seasoned gin enthusiasts, praise the store's creation as a gin that presents a delightful journey on the palate, starting with prominent juniper and a hint of sweetness, transitioning into a lovely dry style complemented by subtle chilli notes. It is refreshing, featuring coriander and woody herbs, alongside some bitter tones, rounded and well balanced. The Hawkridge was presented to the store and Hawkridge Distillers at a glittering ceremony in London. Simon Drake, general manager of the store, said, "We are beyond thrilled to receive these two incredible honours from the spirit industry's most respected global awards. Our London Dry Gin has been blended with passion, curiosity and impeccable flavour in partnership with Hawkridge Distillers. Our guests adore it, and now it's time for the rest of the world to discover it too."
A section of the River Thames in South Oxfordshire has been named as one of the best spots to go wild swimming in the UK. The river through Henley has been described as dreamlike in a top 20 list compiled by The Telegraph. Wild swimming, also known as open water swimming, involves swimming in natural, unchlorinated bodies of water, like rivers, lakes and the sea. The newspaper said, "You will often hear it said that you can't swim anywhere in the Thames, England's longest river. This stretch from Henley to Marlow proves you can. Enter a dreamlike meander between leafy parishes, boat docks, woods and meadows. All the while, the current draws you deeper into the bucolic English countryside. You have the option to swim either a 5.5-kilometre half-marathon, 9-kilometre mid-distance, or the full 14-kilometre marathon."
A touch of Eurovision sparkle is set to delight crowds in the unlikely setting of Blenheim Palace. The majestic, stately home may seem a world apart from the kits glitz of the continental feast of pop, but the Woodstock UNESCO World Heritage Site this week welcomes Britain's plucky contestants Remember Monday, who have dusted themselves off after their nil-point drubbing in the audience vote and are once again ready to rock. The trio of friends, Lauren Byrne, Holly Ann Hull and Charlotte Steele, finished 19th in last month's controversial contest where they performed their song, What the Hell Just Happened. But no one really cares about that, and the girls are now ready to charm the audience for Nocturne Live, where they are supporting The Cause and Natalie Imbruglia on Saturday, June the 21st, and they can't wait to play. Just every single day, we're shocked about everything that's happening to us, and to perform at Blenheim Palace is huge, and especially with The Cause. I mean, we've grown up listening to The Cause, we're huge fans of them, and Natalie Imbruglia. Honestly, there's so much stuff that we don't think we will ever understand how we're managing to tick off these amazing bucket list venues, says Lauren. It's wild. We can't believe we're on the same lineup as these incredible artists that we admired for such a long time at such an incredible venue. It all feels very surreal. Even though the result didn't go the girls' way, they say their Eurovision experience has changed their lives. How has life changed since the news was announced? Every day is a new day of amazing things, and we're so, so grateful that the day we received that phone call happened. We had a little bucket list that we've had for years, and ever since we got Eurovision, we've been ticking it off and upgrading the bucket lists. There are things on our bucket list now that we've ticked off that we just never even would have imagined, so we couldn't be more grateful. Will their Eurovision experience influence how they approach the live show now? Will we see any of that Eurovision sparkle in the Nocturne live set at Blenheim? I think the Eurovision experience definitely kind of set the bar for us now, and we're only aiming for that, or for higher, says Lauren. We've set the bar there, and we just want to keep getting bigger and better. You know, we want to take that level of performance into every single thing we do. You know, we're already making plans for loads of different festival appearances over the summer and even our own live tour. And they plan on making the historic setting of Blenheim Palace their own. I think we love the kind of idea of taking over the place, says Lauren. We really like making a show our own and feeling like everyone stepped into our worlds, and that doesn't really matter where we're performing. We always try and stay authentic to who we obviously are. Blenheim Palace is such an iconic, classy, beautiful venue, and hopefully we will be welcomed with open arms. And now that they've ticked off Eurovision and are set to perform at Blenheim Palace, what's next for Remember Monday? Plenty, says Lauren. We're going on a headline tour in October, she says.
Villagers say that they have made a small fortune after ITV's Downton Abbey was filmed in their community. Bampton, in the west of the county, has served as an outdoor location for the fictional community of Downton, which is set to come to an end in the upcoming film The Grand Finale. The series began filming on its quaint streets in 2010, and it soon became a magnet for tourists from around the world. The tourism boom has divided Bampton, some saying it generated a small fortune from old biddies stuffed with cash buying merchandise, with the money used to improve local buildings and services. But other villagers say they want their front drives free from brash American accents. Busloads of often US fans, fascinated by the historical drama's depiction of early 20th century Britain, come armed with cameras and selfie sticks to Bampton. They tour sites like St Mary's Church, which hosts weddings, christenings and funerals in the show's fictional village. Sightseers choosing to take a guided tour around Bampton and other Downton Abbey locations can be set back as much as £500 each. And now, 6 series and 3 movies after filming began 15 years ago, the rift within the village is ever growing. One elderly volunteer at Bampton Community Hub, which was used to depict the Downton Cottage Hospital, claimed the charity's not-for-profit shop was at one point making £1,000 a day from visitors. It sells a range of Downton goods, including books, snow globes and hats, and features a life-size cutout of Hugh Bonneville. The volunteer said, "It has made us a small fortune, hundreds of thousands of pounds. We've had thousands of visitors. Its popularity with visitors has helped the community fund the reconstruction of its buildings, including the old grammar school, improving services available to locals, such as a village library, an exhibition space, and a community archive. It's mostly Americans," the volunteer added. The elderly ladies helping to run the little shop at first didn't know what to do with all the dollars and other foreign currencies that began filling the till. "It saved our library. It enabled us to restore the interior building. Upstairs we have a social hub. We do events free of charge for the villagers." Other Bampton villagers, however, are more sceptical of the town's association with the franchise. Fabrizio Manerba, a village local, said, "My friend overheard a tour guide saying that Bampton was nothing before Downton Abbey. Let me tell you, Bampton was a beautiful, expensive place to live long beforehand." The 62-year-old described busloads of tourists arriving whatever the weather. He said, "I live on the main square and they often stand in my driveway. They just go everywhere." Di O'Brien described tourists coming at all times, with around 10 buses arriving a day at the town's peak popularity, with visitors lingering and posing for photographs. At the post office, the owner, Pankaj Grover, 40, downplayed the divisiveness of the village politics surrounding the Downton tourism cash cow. "If someone comes in and asks me about Downton, I send them to the community hub. I'm not a competitor." Describing his experience of moving to the town a few months ago, Mr. Grover said he has been surprised by the togetherness the village has. "We are all one community," he said, adding, "they work for each other here. As the world gets more selfish, it's so surprising to find a village like this." But across the road, Lynn Shuker, who works at Arthur's Attic Antiques, said that while the community hub was making lots of money, the busloads of tourists don't contribute to other shops. "They contribute to the library, but apart from that, they don't have enough time. We're better off with individual travellers, with families in cars, not the buses. There's so much more to Bampton than Downton Abbey," she added. Tanya Newland, who was born and raised in Bampton, focused on the chance to revel in the glamour of the big production sets, having been cast as an extra. Ms. Newland said, "I was a villager. I had my hair done in ringlets and had makeup put on. I love the elegance behind the show, which I think we've lost in modern society. It was a lovely experience."
Oxford Operatic Society, OxOps, has announced its upcoming production of Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber's iconic rock star opera, Jesus Christ Superstar. From Tuesday the 8th to Sunday the 13th of July, Oxford Playhouse audiences will be transported into the climatic final days of Jesus of Nazareth, reimagined through electrifying music and captivating performances. Renowned for its dramatic intensity and timeless score, including hits like I Don't Know How I Love Him and Superstar, the show is an enduring favourite, and this version promises to be fabulous. OxOps says, "This production promises to be a compelling exploration of love, betrayal and sacrifice. Our vibrant community group invites everyone to join us for an unforgettable theatrical experience. Whether you're a long-time fan of the show or new to its remarkable legacy, this performance is bound to inspire and captivate." OxOps has been in existence under one name or another since 1907. The City of Oxford Amateur Dramatic Club was founded in 1907, but in the 1920s split into two separate societies, leading to the new City of Oxford Operatic Society. In 1929, the two societies amalgamated again and became known as the City of Oxford Dramatic and Operatic Society. The first production of the Reformed Society is believed to have been Merry England, performed at the New Theatre. The Society continued to perform there until 1932, when the old building was pulled down and the Society moved to the old Oxford Playhouse, known as the Red Barn, in Woodstock Road, until the outbreak of the Second World War. The Oxford Operatic Society was reformed in 1946, largely due to the efforts of Percy Walters, George Walker, and Bill Sawyer. The first production again was Merry England, performed at the Oxford Town Hall. After five further productions, the Society took the momentous step of moving to the Oxford Playhouse in Beaumont Street. Operatic Society's first show there was the Mikado in February 1950. It was the start of a long and happy relationship with the Oxford Playhouse, with the Society performing there regularly ever since, most recently with their production of Funny Girl.
A judicial review challenging a massive reservoir near Abingdon is scheduled to be heard in the High Court in London. The reservoir, which would be southwest of Abingdon, would produce up to 270 million litres of water per day, providing additional water supplies to 15 million people. It is expected to be nearly as big as Gatwick Airport and has faced repeated local opposition. In January, Chancellor Rachel Reeves backed plans for the new reservoir, but Guards, Group Against Reservoir Development, sister company Safer Waters, and countryside charity CPRE Oxfordshire launched a bid for a judicial review. Derek Stork, a director of Safer Waters, said this is a scandalous misuse of public money. Instead of investing in essential sewage clean-up and modern water reuse systems, Thames Water wants to build an untested, bunded structure the height of an eight-storey building that puts communities at risk while lining shareholders' pockets. Lisa Warne, director of CPRE Oxfordshire, said, "The UK is already one of Europe's most wasteful water users per person. We currently reuse just 0.08% of urban wastewater, the lowest rate in Europe. The government should prioritise leakage reduction, water reuse and efficiency, not this vanity reservoir." Ollie Glover, MP for Didcot and Wantage, said, "I and other local Liberal Democrat colleagues have long called for proper transparency and rigorous scrutiny of decision-making around Thames Water's plans for this enormous reservoir near Abingdon. Many of my constituents have significant concerns about the impact of such a large reservoir, and I welcome any opportunity for these concerns to be heard and addressed fully. Given their shoddy record on sewage and wobbly finances, local residents have no faith in Thames Water to properly deliver such a huge and complex project. The reservoir, the £2.2 billion South East Strategic Reservoir option, SESRO, is a Thames Water project designed to cope with increasing demand and climate change. While it has attracted government backing, there has also been criticism from councils and environmentalists ahead of an expected planning application in 2026. The judicial review could lead to major revision of the government's costly and ill-conceived water infrastructure agenda, say campaigners. Last month, embankment tests for a new reservoir were carried out near Steventon. Compacted clay has been formed into 3-metre, 10-foot walls to test ways of containing up to 150 billion litres of water. The reservoir will have embankments up to 25 metres, 80 feet high. A Thames Water spokeswoman said, "Our proposed reservoir will be crucial in securing water supply to 15 million people across the South East, including Thames Water, Affinity Water and Southern Water customers. We're also progressing plans for a vital drought resilience project in London which will be supported by water recycling. We remain confident in our plan to secure water supply for the next 50 years and beyond.
A popular carnival which attracted thousands of people last year has been postponed until 2026 in a tough decision. Cowley Road Carnival made a triumphant return to Oxford in September 2024 following a five-year break. The event relies on funding, sponsorship, stalls and sales, and in the past has been funded or sponsored by the Arts Council, BMW Mini, Brookes University, Global Carnivals, Oxford City Council and its partners. Last year saw a host of dancing, entertainment, food, stores and music, with a procession featuring 25 groups and more than 600 participants to open the event, celebrating the cultural diversity of Oxford. However, last week the organisers announced the carnival would not be returning this year in a short message posted on social media. In case you didn't get the message, there will be no carnival this year till 2026. This was followed with a heartfelt apology issued on Saturday, June the 14th, which said that trustees made the tough but irresponsible decision to pause the event in 2025. The statement said, "Our last post announcing the 2025 carnival pause came across as abrupt, and we understand why many in our community felt upset. That message didn't reflect the care and gratitude we feel for everyone who makes this carnival what it is. After delivering a successful carnival in 2024 with all its colour, energy and unity, we knew we owed it to the city to do even better going forward." They said the decision was made to focus on getting the foundations right, noting governance, staffing and securing sustainable funding. "This isn't a step back. It's a step towards a bigger, better and more secure 2020, they added. The carnival last year was well received and praised by many, including City and County Councillor Emily Kerr, who said, "It was a lovely close to the summer and I really hope it comes back again next year." Entertainment at last year's event included improv, comedy, belly dancing and Japanese drumming, as well as a fun fair, local food stalls and walkabout performances. Organisers say they have told core call groups and partners and applied for new grants, including Oxford City Council's Big Ideas Fund. They have also begun applying to national funders such as the Arts Council and the Heritage Lottery, as well as voluntarily working to plan a sustainable future. They added, "Thank you for your patience, your passion and your pride in the carnival. We're listening and we're committed to making 2026 unforgettable with you." Those who would like to become trustees and community champions can send their CV or a brief letter to admin@cowleyroadcarnival.org.
A city centre cafe has launched a crowdfunding appeal to help pay legal fees for a court case deciding whether it will be evicted. Will Pouget, who runs the Vaults and Gardens Cafe in Radcliffe Square, and cafe operators Fresh Connection are facing an eviction notice from the Parochial Church Council of the University Church of St Mary the Virgin. They're contesting the threatened eviction. An initial county court hearing took place last year and in September. A county court judge in Oxford referred the case to the High Court in London. The hearing is now scheduled to take place in October and a crowdfunding appeal has been launched as legal fees could reach £150,000. Mr Pouget said, "We launched the crowdfunder about a week ago and already more than £7,000 has been raised. I feel bad asking customers for their support and there are arguably many more worthy causes, but we really do need help with the legal costs and the donations so far show that people really do believe in supporting us. The staff feel this is such a lovely show of solidarity They really appreciate it. Two different people gave £999 each. Mr. Pouget said if the cafe wins the case and does not have to pay legal costs, then contributions could be refunded. A statement on the cafe's Save the Vaults fundraiser says, after three preliminary hearings, the case has now been listed to begin on October the 28th in the High Court in London. The cafe's legal costs to date of defending the action have escalated to more than £100,000 and are expected to reach at least £150,000 by the time the trial is concluded. While the Vaults and Garden Cafe has been a profitable venue for 20 years, the sums of money now involved have become too great for the company to manage from its own resources. That's why we need your help. The cafe celebrated its 20th anniversary in 2023, and as staff laid on a series of celebrations, the dispute with the church emerged. Since then, about 15,400 people have signed a petition online calling for Mr. Pouget's cafe to be allowed to stay. The cafe has operated as a small family business with environmental and social benefits to the local community. If the cafe closes, up to 70 staff could face redundancy. Mr. Pouget has said repeatedly he hopes the case can be settled before it goes to court. In 2023, the Parochial Church Council of the University Church said it hoped that a new cafe, operated as a social enterprise and not run by Mr. Pouget, would open in the spring of 2025. The PCC said the new cafe would improve the quality of welcome to University Church. Money planned for an Oxfordshire newlywed's honeymoon ended up being spent on one of their funerals instead. Widow Laura Burr, 32, is campaigning to ensure younger people have full health checkups to detect silent conditions. Primary school teacher Edward Burr, 32, and his wife married at the Banbury United Reformed Church on April 6, 2024. Only 2 weeks later, Mr. Burr began to suffer shortness of breath and went to A&E at Horton General Hospital. He was diagnosed with pneumonia, but his condition didn't improve, and on May 2, 2024, he was transferred to the John Radcliffe Hospital, where he was treated for heart failure. Mrs. Burr said, Ed's doctors said he'd be easier to treat if he had heart failure or pneumonia, but because he had both, they had to prioritise which one was causing him more damage. Although for a time he left hospital, he never truly recovered, and after only weeks was readmitted to the John Radcliffe. There, doctors fitted him with a biventricular asset device, which is designed to support the ventricles if they aren't pumping blood to the heart properly. However, he did not improve, and after being put on the heart transplant list, his condition deteriorated further. The weekend of October the 3rd, I had a very strange feeling, said Mrs. Burr, a helpline operator from Banbury. Not unusually, the chaplain came to bless Ed, which he did every Sunday, but this time, while he was reading the prayer, I started sobbing uncontrollably. Later that day, the doctors informed Mr. Burr's family that the life support device they had fitted was dying and that his life support machine would need to be switched off. Doctors switched off his life support machine as he awaited a heart transplant, with Mrs. Burr holding his hand as he passed. She said, we played him his favourite music and my sister read him a poem, and 196 days after marrying him, I held his hand as he died. Mr. and Mrs. Burr had been saving up for a honeymoon to Disneyland, setting aside some cash each month alongside wedding donations. However, instead, the money was spent on Mr. Burr's funeral. Now Mrs. Burr and her friend Gabriella Evans, who also lost her husband to an undiagnosed heart condition, have set up a campaign to make full health MOTs mandatory for people aged 25 to 35 to detect silent conditions early. The petition states that an estimated 400,000 people have heart failure that is undiagnosed, and that if Mr. Burr had had a health check, his life would have been saved. It is currently on over 5,000 signatures, with the eventual aim being to present it to the NHS and the Department for Health and Social Care.
Notice to listeners of OxTalk who use a smart speaker to access our service. There are new instructions for anyone who listens to OxTalk using Alexa. To listen to OxTalk in this way, you now have to use the Talking Newspaper skill. First, you need to enable it. Simply say, Alexa, enable Talking Newspaper. Then, to listen to OxTalk, please follow this procedure. Alexa, open Talking Newspaper.
Welcome to your Talking Newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have problems listening to OxTalk in this way, it could be due to the way that your Alexa device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set up your device in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact OxTalk and we will try to help. That was the last of our articles for this week. If you have any comments or feedback about OxTalk, you can telephone Margaret on 07496 062280. That's 07496 062280. Please remember to leave your name and a contact number with your message. Alternatively, you can send an email to mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and those from previous weeks are available on our website, www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen directly or download the audio file. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more news, so until then, we hope you have a good week.